Becoming Chinese in Montana, Political Activism Among Montana's Historic Chinese Communities. That is the title of Mark Johnson's Extreme History presentation. That Montana had a large Chinese population in the late 19th century is well known. However, most analysis of this community focuses solely on the challenges and contributions in the American West, paying little attention to the transnational nature of the Chinese experience. By understanding Montana's Chinese pioneers through a global lens, they can be seen as active and engaged participants who used the skills gained through their time in the American West to work for self-improvement and to strengthen a severely weakened China that they had temporarily left but never forgotten. Johnson, an awarded teacher at the University of Notre Dame, opened his talk with a question to the audience. What did they know about Chinese in Montana? He also solicited audience input at several other points in the talk. Recorded August 17, 2017, at the Museum of the Rockies.
Railroad workers, definitely, absolutely. Gold mining, called it Jinshan, Gold Mountain, and thought about it as a place where you'd go away from China to get rich. Did they plan to stay here indefinitely? Get rich and take those riches home, take an elevated status home. Good. What about the demographics? Men, women, what are we talking about? Mostly men. We do know that some women came and they had some interesting experiences in the American West as well. Okay, so we have railroads, we have gold miners, laundries, absolutely, and that will be central to our story as well. And so you know quite a bit about the general story of the Chinese experience in Montana and the broader American West, but I want to know more, right? So as an historian, I would want records. What type of records could tell us something about their numbers in Montana? Census records. In 1870, the territorial census, Montana, of course, wasn't a state yet, the territorial census had the Chinese population of Montana at as high as 10, maybe as high as 15% of our then territory of Montana's entire population. The 2010 census had the Chinese population, or the entire Asian population of the state, at less than 1%. So in our early days, we were extraordinarily diverse. As much as 15% of Montana's population was Chinese. That's interesting. So this census should tell us some things. It should tell us name, gender, age, where they came from, right? Unfortunately, this is what the census tells us. And you can kind of understand, the census takers probably didn't speak Chinese, and they went from door to door to door and couldn't understand the words that were coming out of the residents' mouths. And so they generalized. But I think even this small snippet is pretty interesting. China boy, 6 years old, male. We see two Chinese women there. But it seemed like a dead end when we got to the census, that we couldn't really flesh out this population, know them by name, know their thoughts, their dreams, their hopes. It was an outsider's perspective on this very crucial population of our state's history. And some historians and the general story has become this, that traces of their culture has disappeared and their stories have become obscured in myth and legend, that we can't get to a deeper understanding of the Chinese experience in Montana. That's not good enough for me. I think we can. And I know there's somebody in the audience tonight who's working on writing a children's story, a children's history, who hopes that this isn't true as well, right? Wants to dig deeper and personalize these stories and get a sense of what the hopes and dreams and aspirations of these people were. And so I thought that this obscured in the mists of the past, that's not good enough. Through a little bit of elbow grease and maybe a deeper understanding of world history, I think we can come to know this population. I want to know him. Does he look capable of deep thought? Absolutely. Does he look capable of setting goals and overcoming obstacles to attain those goals? Absolutely. I want to know his hopes, his dreams. Are there others like him? Are they going to be combined together in a common cause? What stands in their way and how do they overcome those obstacles? Get around them, go over them, go under them? I want to try and personalize his story. But it's difficult to get to the story of the Chinese in Montana because at this moment in time, many of them didn't even consider themselves Chinese. Okay, they were quite fragmented. Are they even Chinese at this moment in time? We would think so from an outsider's perspective. But realistically, at the time, they were fragmented along family lines, clan lines, linguistic differences. Different dialects in southern China, where most of these people came to America from, were vastly different when you went from one mountain range across to the next. And so they would have identified less as nationalistically Chinese and more based on their clan, their family, and the dialect they spoke. And that's part of the reason I call tonight's talk Becoming Chinese in Montana. There were a set of circumstances that bound them together as proud and strong Chinese people here in the American West, more specifically here in our beloved state of Montana. Okay? And so we have to look at those obstacles at first. And the Chinese in the West do show up in the historic record quite often, but usually they're people that things happen to. And unfortunately, they did face a lot of racism and discrimination. In one direction, this was very much top-down. The U.S. government and the states putting immigration restrictions on the Chinese population. Where at one time they'd welcomed them in as workers to build the railroad, when times got tough and economic competition got difficult, they were barred. They were excluded. In 1882, that was reaffirmed in 1892. And so the path to come legally to the United States of America was made quite a lot more difficult. And you can see the political cartoons that are mocking them, mocking their dress, mocking their hairstyle, and asking Uncle Sam to kick this population out in immigration debates at the time, 150 years ago. And you could draw some parallels to what's going on in America today. But this oppression from the top down was mirrored, unfortunately, from oppression from the bottom up. And that tended to be characterized by mass expulsion and violence that was visited upon the Chinese populations from mobs at the bottom levels of society. And this happened all across the American West. In 1871 in Los Angeles, there was a major anti-Chinese riot. You can see some of the other major instances of anti-Chinese violence across the state of California. In Washington, the Chinese were forcibly expelled from Tacoma and other places. It didn't always rise to the level of a massacre necessarily, but forced expulsion, taken to the edge of town or the edge of the state, and your belongings had to be left behind and you were robbed of that property is a type of violence nonetheless. So we've got California, we've got Washington, we've got Oregon, where in the 1880s there was a massacre, China Massacre Cove, 1887, with 34 Chinese miners killed. No justice was ever dealt out. This is a monument that was laid there about 6 years ago. It's in English, it's in Nez Perce, the native peoples of the area, and it's in Chinese. So we had Washington, Oregon, California. We've got Idaho, 50 Chinese taken from Shoshone, Idaho, and expelled. We've got Wyoming and Colorado. In 1880, there was a major anti-Chinese riot in Denver. And I'm sure many of you have heard of the Rock Springs Massacre in 1885, where almost 30 Chinese miners were killed. So we've got mass expulsion and violence in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Colorado, Wyoming. What should be next? Montana. Something's different about Montana, I argue. And I don't claim to know exactly what is different, but there was never a mass expulsion or a mass massacre on par with the rest of the American West. And that'll be kind of part of our story tonight. There's something different about the Chinese population in Montana. Okay? But this story, like I mentioned, they do pop up in the history books, but it's normally as people that things happen to. That the Chinese are passive, that they don't have any agency, that these things are visited upon them. I want to try and flip that story and try to understand from their perspective what their thoughts and dreams and hopes were in this. I want to, again, get back to him. He's capable of deep thought. I want to know what's on his mind. I want to know what his job is. I want to know who he hangs out with. I want to know where he travels. And I think that we can recover that story and get past this idea that the Chinese are shrouded in the mists of the past. Yeah, they left a few things behind, but that's all that remains. No, I think we can get to a deeper understanding because he's flanked by a couple of colleagues. And there's even more of them. Now, these aren't mugshots, right? They're intentionally posed, and they're choosing to belong to this organization. This organization is called the Chinese Empire Reform Association. I'll say it again. The Chinese Empire Reform Association. They're right here. This is the Chinese Empire Reform Society, or the Chinese Empire Reform Association of Butte, Montana. Shouldn't surprise you. Butte had a major Chinese population. Butte had the largest Chinatown in the Rocky Mountain West, even larger than Denver. So it maybe doesn't surprise you. Okay? But these guys, there's some interesting things going on here. And again, it's Butte, but we also have one from Marysville, Montana. Quite a few smaller in size, of course. How many of you know where Marysville, Montana is at? Good. So you'll understand why it has these naval ships. Marysville's off, obviously a deep water port with good access. No. No. So something's going on here. Marysville's up in the mountains. It's a ghost town today. They serve some good steaks up there at the Marysville house and things like that. But something was going on here. These men chose to be part of this group, and they chose how they were portrayed. I found these at the Montana Historical Society a number of years ago, and I'd never heard of the Chinese Empire Reform Association. I'd never heard of this story of the American West. And so I wondered if maybe just a knowledge of American Western history wasn't enough to tell this story in its totality. Maybe you needed to understand world history and specifically Chinese history as well. And since I was blessed to live in Shanghai, China for 8 years, I tried to tap into that side of history and tell this story more fully. But as I came across this document, my interest was piqued. I was intrigued. And let's see what you can make of this. Turn and talk. What questions does this bring up for you? We've got Committee of the Chinese Empire Reform Association, Marysville, Montana. But what does this make you wonder? So we've already got some questions out there. I see some people asking what year. This is from 1901. Who is this? That's definitely a question. And if we go back a couple, we'll see that he's also on the Butte Society's page as well. Clearly he's important. Look at the artwork here around him versus the Marysville one. It's a little bit different, so they're personalizing it. Maybe they're saying something different. I'm not sure. But great question. Who is this person that's on the masthead of both posters? That was a question right away. Good job. That word reform, it brings up a lot. What do you want to change it to? And what had it been that you were dissatisfied with? There's a moment of agency and action right there. What are we trying to achieve? So that idea of reform. And what do we mean by empire? Is China saying that America is part of its empire? I'm not sure. There's something going on there. But that word reform, absolutely. These are definitely military ships. I don't think they're Chinese military ships at the time. They're either Western or possibly Japanese. But the Marysville community is saying something about that. Again, it has no access to the sea, but it's intentionally clipped these images out and put them on the masthead for some reason, so let's try to get to that reason. Great, great. This gentleman is very much still sticking to traditional dress. We'll talk about their sartorial choices later on tonight, and you've got some Western dress as well. Is it the same with the Butte example? So my interest was piqued, and I wanted to try and get to a deeper understanding of what's going on. Let's start first with this gentleman up here. He is the Guangxu Emperor. Sometimes you'll see it in the documents you'll read tonight as Guangxu, depending on how the Chinese language was transliterated into English. He is the Guangxu Emperor. Born in 1871, but throughout most of his life, he was not actually in control of China, of the Qing Dynasty, which controlled China at this moment in time. He should have been, but he wasn't. There was a person ruling in his stead. Does anybody know who was actually controlling power in China at this time? Not a bad guess. They defeated the Chinese in 1894-95. But in terms of Chinese leaders, the Dowager Empress, Cixi. I'm horrible with that one. She is in total control of China. Now, she's related to the true emperor, but she is very reluctant to give up control. She's been in control for a long time, but it hasn't been going very well. She tried what's called the self-strengthening movement to try and make China strong. Unfortunately for China, China was defeated by another Asian nation that had recently become strong, Japan. In 1894-95, in the Sino-Japanese War, China did not fare well. She's quite old at this moment in time, and so she wants to kind of advance into retirement, and she's giving more control over to the true emperor, the Guangxu Emperor. But he's got some different ideas. She is very conservative. He wants to modernize, liberalize, and move China forward in maybe a more Western direction. And as he gains control, he tries to go in that direction. Based on the advice of two advisors, Kang Youwei on the left and Liang Qichao on the right, Kang is considered one of the most brilliant Confucian scholars of all of Chinese history. And right at this moment in time, he's in his ascendancy. And he gets the ear of the Guangxu Emperor and actually has the longest single audience with a Chinese emperor in world history. And in this audience, he convinces the Guangxu Emperor of the rightness of what he already wanted to do. Westernize, modernize, move China forward in a different direction than the Dowager Empress had been taking China for quite some time. And so with the advice of Liang and Kang, the Guangxu Emperor institutes the 100 Days of Reform. Now, he didn't call it the 100 Days of Reform. Okay, critical thinking and problem-solving time. How long do you think the 100 Days of Reform is going to last? 103 days, a little bit off, okay? But it's named after it fails. It does not go very well. But let's look at this moment when the Guangxu Emperor was trying to institute this change. Kong tells the Guangxu Emperor why we need to do this as Chinese. A survey of all states in the world will show that those states that undertook reforms and became strong, like Japan, while those states that clung to the past perished. If the Guangxu Emperor, Your Majesty, observes the trends in the other countries, you will see that if we can change, we can preserve ourselves, but if we can't, we shall perish. And so with Kong and Liang as his advisors, he moves forward with the 100 days of reform. And the goals are kind of echoed in the masthead of the Marysville Society. Create a modern navy. Study European and American governments and military and adopt Western aspects to make China stronger and stronger. Reforms in education. Go away from the age-old Confucian exam system. It was outdated. It was thousands of years old. We needed to modernize. Study economics, foreign affairs, reward inventors and authors. Establish mines and railroads. These are the key aspects of the 100 days of reform that the Guangxu Emperor wants to push forward on the advice of Kong and Liang. But another advisor, Tan Zitong, who was also in line with Kong and Liang, said, this is all great, but we've got some problems. China has been so closed off for so long that it has not allowed scholars to go out and study other countries. The Middle Kingdom, China, thought in quite an arrogant way that it had all the answers. And so what could we learn from going out and coming in with other people's ideas? And Tan says, hey, in China, during the last several decades, where have we had genuine understanding of foreign cultures that you now want to adopt? When have we had scholars or officials who could discuss these ideas? If they had been able to discuss foreign matters, there would have been no such incident as the defeat by the Japanese in the Sino-Japanese War. Tan Zitong says, you know, you think you understand the West, but you understand it superficially. You've never dreamed of or seen the beauty and perfection of Western legal systems and political institutions. All that you speak of are the branches and the foliage of foreign matters, not the roots. So all you very smart Confucian scholars, you want to modernize and westernize, but we don't have the experiences to do that. If only we had a Chinese population that's been out and seen the West. And so Tan and his other, they don't disagree, but they just don't know how they're going to do this. Especially they don't know how they're going to do this because the Dowager Empress doesn't like it at all and she retakes control. Tan Zitong and five others are captured and executed. That kind of puts a damper on your reform efforts, right? Tan Zitong, when he's been sentenced to death, speaks out the night before his execution as the Dowager Empress has retaken control. And Tan Zitong talks about, you know, if blood is to be spilt, let my blood be first if it's for the greater glory of China. Reform has never come about in any country without the flow of blood. Now, he's not talking about a revolution here, but he's saying, no one in China in modern times has sacrificed himself for the cause of reform, and because of this, China is still a poor and backward country. Therefore, I request that the sacrifices begin with myself. And the night before his execution, etched on the walls of his prison cell, is this. Are there any parallels in American history? What did Patrick Henry say? Give me liberty or give me death. Nathan Hale, I regret that I have. So there's some interesting parallels at key moments of our nation's history. So the 100 days of reform is ended. The conservatives retake control under the Dowager Empress, and they work to undo all the gains that had been made or had been in planning. Kong and Liang should have been executed, but they escape. They get wind of the conservative reaction, and they escape from China with their heads still on their shoulders. They go into exile, and they seek Chinese around the world who have the means of mining and railroad technology and Western legal systems and Western political institutions to try to achieve this reform of their beloved China. And they begin the Chinese Empire Reform Association. Now, the Emperor Guangxu is not killed. He's put under house arrest, where we know the other half of the story. He'll stay there until his death in 1908. But they still want to institute the Guangxu Emperor as the rightful ruler of China and make China strong through westernized, modernized, progressive directions. But when they go to North America, and the Chinese Empire Reform Association actually has branches all over the world, in New Zealand and Australia, Singapore, Burma, Japan, Mexico, Canada, but mostly across the American West. And in my research, it tells us that the greatest concentration of branches is in Montana, of this global organization. But when Liang Qichao goes out and tries to tap into the experiences of the overseas Chinese, he's not too inspired. North America's largest Chinatown is in San Francisco, and he's not pleased with what he sees by the Chinese in San Francisco. He talks about their village mentality, and this is like I talked about where they were clannish, they weren't bound together by a national identity, and Liang is frustrated by what he sees, and he's not able to tap into this population very effectively. And so he's quite discouraged. But when he visits Montana in 1903, and then Kong Youwei visits Montana in 1905, he finds something different. Montana's Chinese are the most organized and efficient that he comes across in his entire travels, in his own words. So what's different about Montana's Chinese communities? We would think that Kong and Liang, these brilliant scholars, would bring enlightenment and ideas and empowerment to Montana's Chinese. In fact, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think they find empowerment amongst Montana's Chinese. And we go back to Tan Sitong's claim, looking at the bottom. You've never dreamed, ever seen the beauty and perfection of Western legal systems and political institutions. They needed Chinese who had seen Western legal systems in action, had seen Western political institutions in action. And they find them in Montana. The reason this happens is in 1896-97, there was an attempt at expulsion like we'd seen in California and Idaho and Wyoming and Colorado. By this point in Montana's history, Chinese were not allowed to work in the underground mines of Butte. Chinese were barred from most other occupations. And so they'd gone into laundry work and gone into restaurant work. But even that economic niche that they'd carved out was challenged. In 1896 and 97, white-controlled labor unions in Butte sought to eradicate any Chinese economic power in the city. And so they instituted a boycott against Chinese and Japanese residents of Butte. The Japanese residents were able to go to their consulate, and since Japan was a nation to be reckoned with and growing in power at this time, the resistance against the Japanese kind of died away. But against the Chinese, because China wasn't strong enough to take its own affairs into order back home, how could it protect its citizens abroad? And so they tried to have people boycott Chinese restaurants. If they knew of people who were patronized Chinese laundries, they would be followed and intimidated. So try to get every white person in Butte to not give a dime to any Chinese person in Butte. And if you can economically cut them out, that support out from under them, they will be forced to leave. Now, the Chinese in Butte didn't know what to do, and so they go to the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, also called the Chinese Six Companies. It's this umbrella aid organization based in San Francisco that should give aid to Chinese across North America. Now, realistically, the Qing Dynasty, the Chinese emperor, should give aid. It was in such a state of chaos and disarray that it couldn't. So there's this umbrella organization of these very serious-looking men. And Montana's Chinese say, hey, we want to fight this boycott legally. Will you help us? And the Chinese Six Company said, don't. Now, you can understand why they said that. They'd seen violence in Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, California. And they thought if you stick your head up a little bit, that same violence might be visited upon you. The Chinese in Butte didn't take that as an answer, and they fought it anyways. They fight back against it in the legal system. They bring suit that this was an infringement on their 14th Amendment rights, equal protection under the law. And since all the Chinese in Butte can't traipse into the courtroom, they circulate a petition to say, can we speak in your stead? And here's a petition. This is one page of about 12 pages of that petition with 300 Chinese in Butte. Sign it saying, yes, we want to fight this, and yes, you can speak for us. Now, they can't be lawyers, and so they get a very famous lawyer in Montana history, Wilbur Fisk Sanders, one of the original vigilantes, a strong Republican at this moment in time, and he will argue their case. And he wins the case. It's not a massive monetary victory, but it's a symbolic victory very much. And this use of the legal system gives the Chinese in Butte and the Chinese in Montana experience with the legal system, the political institutions. It makes them feel proud and strong. And it's exactly at this moment that that Liang Qichao and Kong Youwei and the others come into Montana and find this vibrant, strong, proud Chinese population. And the Chinese six companies have to eat their words a little bit. Didn't make him smile anymore. I wish I had a before and after picture. And so Kong and Liang visit, but I don't think that they brought enlightenment. I think they thought they were going to. They're these elevated, high-class Chinese who are going to come and deal with these peasant miners, laundry workers, and restaurateurs and enlighten them. It went exactly the other way around. They find an empowered group amongst the Chinese. And the Chinese in Montana, I don't think they care that much about the Guangxu Emperor, to be honest. But they do care about their own survival and economic prosperity. And they realize that if China can be stronger, it can protect them abroad. And so if we can come up with a way to westernize, liberalize, move China forward, then their status, wherever they're at across the American West or around the world, will be enhanced. And so even before, this is years before Kong and Liang visit Montana, the Chinese communities in Butte and Helena file documents with the Montana Secretary of State to become incorporated entities. Think about that. This is in 1901. They become incorporated entities. They file the proper paperwork. We have records of it. Okay? Articles of incorporation for the Chinese Empire Reform Society of Helena and again of Butte. And here's their document. And so we see they value education and scientific principles and U.S. constitutional principles, useful knowledge. Is there anything in there that talks about the Guangxu Emperor? No, the Montana Secretary of State doesn't care about Chinese imperial politics. So I think the Chinese in Montana had some different goals maybe than Kong and Liang, but some shared ideas as well. Now this was the document from Helena and Butte branches, so the articles of incorporation were identical in Helena and Butte, and that talks to the interconnectedness of Montana's Chinese communities. But in this same article that talks about they filed paperwork with the Secretary of State, they're also mocked. There is this political cartoon showing them with the queue and mocking their hairstyle and maybe their opium smoking and gambling habits. So in the same article that talks about their empowerment and their proper use of legal institutions, it mocks them. And it says, yeah, the Chinese in Helena are strong. You want to know how strong? You stand at the corner downtown a couple of blocks away from Chinatown, and the Chinese in Helena are strong. Okay? Even if you've been drinking Henry Zayas's whiskey, you'll still be able to smell the Chinese from Chinatown. And so obviously there's some racism, there's some thoughts of oppression in the same article that talks about this moment of empowerment. Does that impact the Chinese though? No, they move forward nonetheless. And as I looked at these documents of the articles of incorporation, I found the actual documents, the Butte branch and the Helena branch. And what I found was interesting, you've got the people who are signing their names. Some don't know how to write in English, so they're writing in Chinese characters. But this guy was in both places, Gong He. He was there when the Helena branch became incorporated, and he was there when the Butte branch became incorporated. And so I researched into who this Gong He was. Turns out he's not from Montana. He's from Portland. And he visits Montana to help start this cause. And I think just looking at him in a moment in this microcosm can help us understand what the Montana Chinese were thinking about. He's a self-taught electrician in Portland. In 1903, he returns to Guangzhou, China, to do his part for the awakening of his countrymen. He wrote a book on electricity in Chinese that was then circulated all throughout China. And on his trip to Montana, he and Liang Qichao's cousin were the first Chinese ever to visit Yellowstone. And he wrote a book in Chinese about Yellowstone. We know that he wrote that. I have no idea where it's at. So if anybody stumbles across it, you've got a gem there. Okay. But to do my part to the awakening of China. So he left the American West and went back to China to try and use his electrical skills, his knowledge of the West, to try and strengthen China once and for all. And we found in an archaeological dig in Butte this medallion of the Chinese Empire Reform Association. There's the Guangxu Emperor. These were spread all across the world, and so we see similar ones in Australia and Singapore, but it was interesting to have dug this up in Butte. Okay, so we've got this connection to a global phenomenon. This is a picture from 1905 when Kong Youwei, right here, visits Butte. And he goes on a tour of the original mine. Now you can understand why he'd want to tour a mine, right? to try and mine China's resources to strengthen China. So who are all these other yahoos who are with him here? These are actors from a production of Ben-Hur that was put on in Butte at the time, with life-size horses that would run on rollers on the track. So they have no idea what's going on in terms of Chinese politics, but he's there with his interpreter and with their bodyguard, the small Chinese contingent going to tour this mine in Butte. And when Liang Qichao visits in 03, he finds a strengthened Chinese community, and Kong finds the same. And they didn't bring empowerment and enlightenment, but they found it there. Now, these are the branches that are claimed by Liang Qichao to have existed all over Montana. So we know Helena. What would this number 4 be? That's your Marysville. We've got Butte and we've got Bozeman and we've got Billings, Miles City. Fort Benton. Haver. So spread in places large and small. Now, I've not found any documentary evidence to substantiate the claim that Bozeman had its own Chinese Empire Reform Association. Liang Qichao claims that. We know that Livingston did, but I haven't found any records to substantiate that Bozeman did. So there's maybe some work to be done there. But I've got some articles. The Chinese in Butte armed themselves and trained as military units in the streets of Butte in 1903, 1904, 1905. Target practice, they were giving commands in English. They actually partnered with some Spanish-American War veterans to become a military entity. Not to take on the oppression that they were facing in Butte, but maybe to go back as a conquering army back in China. But think about that. 1896, 1897, there's a citywide boycott, and a couple of years later, the Chinese community in Butte is so empowered that they're marching around with weapons. Like, that's different. That's different. That's interesting to me. And I've got those articles. They founded schools. They founded scientific institutions, all with this idea of empowering themselves so they could strengthen the nation and be made stronger as a people around the world. They wanted to do away with dialects that caused division amongst the Chinese. And so this is that moment where they're becoming Chinese in our beloved state of Montana. They're having a national identity. They're having pride. They're working towards a nationally unifying dialect. Quite exciting. And their dress and hairstyles needed to reform as well. This is one of our gentlemen on the Butte Chinese Empire Reform Association. And he's got the standard hairstyle called the Q. There would be a ponytail going down his back that we can't see. And his head would be shaved here. This is a sign of loyalty to the Qing Dynasty. And it was enforced upon all Chinese, whether you're back home or whether you're abroad. And the saying went that if you keep your hair, meaning that if you don't shave right here, keep your hair, lose your head. And so if you ever wanted to go back to China, you had to have this hairstyle as a man. And most of the Chinese in the American West were men. And so you see him in his Chinese dress and his Chinese hairstyle, but we also see some differences amongst his compatriots. This man's made a different choice, right? Both in his hairstyle and in his dress. You see the lapel pins. We've got 33 men altogether. Some are in Western dress. Some are in Chinese dress. I'm interested in this guy. Can we get to his thought process at this moment when he intentionally posed for this photograph? I would like to have his diary. I couldn't read it, but I know some people who maybe could. But I think we can crack into his thought process at this moment in time. Anybody want to pick apart something you see there? Why do you say he's not going home? Look, he's growing his hair back. We've got a lapel pin that's an American flag. Good eyes, good eyes. If you look back here, this gentleman's also wearing American flag lapel pin and the Guangxu Emperor. Of the 33 of them, only 3 have the American flag lapel pin. And like I said, this isn't a mugshot where you're thrown up in front of the camera. You're intentionally designing how you want to portray yourself. Now, this man is both Chinese and American. So he has not shaved his hair in a little while. He's going away from that Q style, which, as the gentleman in the front says, means he's probably doesn't have 1 foot in China and 1 foot in America. He's maybe siding more towards staying in America. What else about him? Most of the men who have the Q hairstyle also are dressed like what? Chinese-style dress. He is not. Western-style dress, but these other gentlemen have Western-style dress, but their hair has already grown out. We have this man in a moment of transition. where he's intentionally saying something about his personhood, his thoughts, his goals, his dreams, his ambitions. Do you think he cares that much about the Guangxu Emperor? No, but he cares about his own status, his own identity, and his own opportunities. And if China can be made strong, his opportunities will be enhanced. And so, going back to how we started this, the 1870 census says all we can know about them is China man, China man, China woman, China boy, China man. And that their stories have been obscured by the myths of history. No, I think we can know more. And so you remember that gentleman who I wanted to know what his deep thoughts were, where he travels, what's his job, what does he do, what are his hopes, his dreams, and his methods of achieving those dreams? This gentleman is Hao Si. He's the state lecturer of the Chinese Empire Reform Association, has visited every one of them except Missoula. But don't worry, he'll visit Missoula when he gets back, because right now he's in Chicago, meeting with others to spread this common cause. And so their stories are not shrouded in the mists of the past. With some knowledge of Chinese history, of world history, and with some linguistic skills that I'll talk about a little bit later, we can know their thoughts, their dreams, their hopes, their ambitions. They're not passive people that things happen to. They've got agency, they've got ideas, they've got action. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. It's a great question. There's one very famous Chinese member of the Butte Society who's not in this group. His name is Dr. Hui Pak, and he chose not to join. And I actually like that. If every member of Butte's Chinese Society had joined, then it's maybe just more social. But to have Hui Pak saying, no, I will not join this, maybe says something about his politics or his class status. Again, he's a doctor. He's admired not only by the Chinese in Butte, but by the non-Chinese population. And Hui Pak also might have been, instead of supporting the reseating of the Guangxu Emperor, who's a Qing Dynasty Manchu, Hui Pak might have been supporting another movement led by Sun Yat-sen, who wants to do away with the Qing Dynasty altogether. And so we've got some maybe class differences going on, but maybe the direction of China is pulling them apart a little bit as well. In terms of if any of these men were born in America, probably not any of the younger ones. It's actually an interesting fact that because there's such a small Chinese female population, it would have been quite unusual to have people born here. But there were Chinese born in the 1860s, 1870s. And as you know, if you're born on American soil, you become an American citizen. So there's a whole lot going on there. Other questions? That's the emperor that's under house arrest. So he will remain under house arrest, like I mentioned, until his dying day. Now, his death has an interesting story as well. The Dowager Empress dies, I believe it's November 15th, 1908. So she was still alive the last time the Cubs won the World Series. Nothing against the Cubs. I mean, obviously they won more recently. But I think that just kind of shortens this span of history, doesn't it? This isn't ancient history. So she dies November 15th, 1908, the day before the Guangxu Emperor died. He dies on November 14th. Coincidence? A sample of his hair was recently tested within the last 10 years, and he had arsenic levels 2,000 times the normal. It's thought that the Guangxu Emperor was probably poisoned. The thinking is that the Dowager Empress didn't want him still around after she died because she knew that he would take China in a direction she didn't agree with. So the Qing Dynasty falls apart shortly afterwards and is replaced by Sun Yat-sen. And the moment that the Qing Dynasty falls, Sun Yat-sen is not in China. He's in Denver, Colorado, trying to get support for the overthrow of the Qing Dynasty. And so you've got Kong Youwei, you've got Liang Qichao, you've got Sun Yat-sen going to the Chinese in the American West. Here's an example of his travels. Now, we know there's a massive Chinese population in Montana. Sun Yat-sen skirts around them because they weren't sympathetic to his cause. He doesn't want to put the Guangxu Emperor back in charge. He wants to tear down the entire imperial system of China. So the Chinese Empire Reform Association was not successful in its stated goal, but in terms of empowering and building upon an identity that was forged in the American West, it very much was successful. Good question. The Boxer Rebellion happens around the same time period in 1900. It's a northern Chinese phenomenon up in Shandong province. The vast majority of the Chinese who came to the West are from southern China. And so while it's happening at the same time, they're really not having common cause with that. Now, the Dowager Empress does get tied up in all that, and that kind of hastens the beginning of the end. but it really doesn't spill over into the Chinese communities in the American West. I asked that same question, and I looked exhaustively for that, and I didn't find much. They were not allowed to. Chinese could not become naturalized citizens until after 1943. So if you were born on American soil, you're a citizen. But Chinese could not emigrate and take legal paths to become citizens. And it's only in 1943, when America is fighting against Japan, China is fighting against Japan, that America finally erases the Chinese Exclusion Act, allowing migration of Chinese to America to the tune of 105 per year. Not 105,000, 105. And so it's symbolic much more than it is in reality. Yes? There's an interesting parallel. So that idea of training abroad to go home and liberate your people back home, it's interesting. Now, the Chinese in Butte did have this military branch. They weren't the only ones, but it seems kind of unique. And they did find a military leader. Okay, this gentleman is the military leader they found, Homer Lee. His last name is L-E-A, but it's pronounced Lee. He convinced Kong Youwe that he was related to Robert E. Lee, who's obviously Chinese, right? Robert E. Lee. Maybe he's Korean, I don't know. But this guy, he's very interesting. He's about 5'1". He's hunchback. He's physically interesting. He's got some deformities. But he's got a brilliant military mind. Never physically able to be a military leader, but intellectually very capable. And so Kong Youwe puts and he's not Chinese, he puts the Chinese Empire Reform Association under the leadership of Homer Lee. And they do try this kind of minor revolution back in China, in southern China. It doesn't go very well. And after that, things fall apart for the military aspirations. But at that moment, when Homer Lee and the overall army that they're building falls apart, some white reporters in Butte go to the Chinese who are training in Butte and said, "What are you guys doing? Didn't you hear? It didn't work." And they said, "Yeah, we're still going to train. We think it does the boys good." Right? They don't care that much about Chinese politics. If they can feel empowered and protected here, that's what they're looking for. Yes? The other types of laws, there was an anti-miscegenation law. So Chinese could not marry non-Chinese in Montana until, I think, 1954. So again, that question of how many of them were born here, you couldn't have these mixed marriages that maybe would produce offspring that's born on American soil. Mining claims, so early on they had mining claims. Generally they could have placer mining claims along the edge of waterways. And usually it was after white miners had moved on and thought there's nothing left there. So we're going to move on, fine, you can have that mining claim. And then the Chinese, because that's all they were left with, would actually make a go of it with that. And so their diligence and their stick-to-itiveness really did make that pay off. But then some myths emerged that the Chinese were sneaking under white miners' cabins and getting the gold dust that fell between the cracks of the cabin and stuff. So, I mean, you can't win, right? But in Butte, we're not talking placer mining, we're talking underground mining, okay? And the Chinese in Butte were barred from working in the underground mines for 60 years. But we happen to know the first man who was not this gentleman. He came to Butte in the 1930s, stays in Butte until the 1950s, He's a laundry worker, and then he's one of the first Chinese workers to work in the underground mines in 60 years. He starts his work there in 1941. Now, what might have caused the laws to lessen there? Manpower needs from the war, okay? And we're partnering with China to try and defeat Japan. The other thing is, he claims he's an American citizen. Wait, he wasn't born in America. His father claimed he was an American citizen, yet he wasn't born in America. Grandpa was born in San Francisco in 1878, went back to China and had children. Now, if you're an American citizen and you have kids, what are they? So Grandpa has a son. The son has several sons. One of them is this gentleman named Wing Hong Hum. He comes to America and is admitted as a U.S. citizen in 1933. No questions asked. His brother tries to come in 1948. 1949, 1950, 1958, is not allowed in. Yet shouldn't he be an American citizen? Yeah. Times had changed, and the Cold War had caused a fear of red Chinese Chi Com infiltration. So Hum Wing Hum desperately works to try and get his brother out of war-torn China, war-torn by World War II and war-torn by the Chinese Civil War, and into safety in America. We've got 250 letters back and forth from Wing Hong Ham and his brother Wing Goon Ham, trying to reunite the family. The American legal restrictions are constantly changing, and Wing Hong Ham does everything that's asked. He'll submit all the paperwork, and then he gets a letter back and says, yes, you submitted everything, but I'm sorry, there's been a new law that's been amended to, now you need a blood test. Now you need this. Now you need that. Now you need old family photographs. And so we translated these documents, and you hear him writing, saying, hey, do you have any old family photographs, or did they all get burned up when our village was destroyed by the Japanese? Now, how did we translate these documents? With help of people like Yuka Rochelle. Yeah, this is a project that we did when I was working in Shanghai. We found these documents at the Montana Historical Society. Two sets of documents, one from about 1880 to 1920, and another in the 1930s to 1950s. And the Montana Historical Society people said, oh yeah, those things, we don't know anybody who reads Chinese. And I said, I know a few people who read Chinese. But this isn't the Chinese writing style that 1.4 billion Chinese can read today, because the written system was simplified in the 1950s. So this is traditional writing style. You needed to either be of a certain age, a certain educational level, or a certain geography, maybe from Hong Kong or Taiwan, to read these documents. But what we did is I came to Montana with several students who could read them, and back in Shanghai we had people like Yuka organizing people to translate the documents, moms, grandmas, grandpas, people from with the language abilities to do this, to try and tell the story of the Chinese in their own words. And so here you see Wing Goon Ham, who's stuck in Hong Kong at this time, saying, hey, brother, you need to find a powerful Westerner and ask him to be the guarantor of our documents. And so Wing Hong Ham in Montana finds a powerful Westerner named Mike Mansfield. But even with the help of Senator, he was actually a representative at the time, Representative Mansfield, even that can't grease the wheels to the point that Wing Goon Ham gets the safety. And so we did this project about 5 years ago, and the story just dried up. The documents were fascinating, and the work was really invigorating, but we never knew what happened to Wing Goon Ham. Did he ever get out of war-torn China and reunited with his brother in Montana or in America? And I actually found his daughter about 3 months ago. She lives in Seattle. And I asked her, whatever happened to Wing Goon Ham? She said he never made it out. He stayed in China until he died in the 1980s. And now we're working to try and put these documents into the hands of the family and tell the story more fully. So it's been a great project with the help of people like Yuka, and just an interesting way to look at history. And I've been blessed and pleased to do it. And I just want to say, in closing, that the Extreme History Project does things like this. They look at history through an interesting angle, an interesting perspective, and do such fascinating and important work. You all see what's going on across our country today. You have to understand your history to engage in these debates. And I thank you for being interested and inquisitive and coming out tonight. Thank you.